Welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. This podcast features in-depth explorations into the traditions of yoga, Sanskrit, Indian philosophy, and South Asian religions. Through candid conversations with scholars and practitioners, we will immerse in the latest and most cutting-edge research on all things yoga. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of the Yogic Studies Podcast. In this episode, I had the privilege of being joined by Dr. Ian Baker, author and scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. Ian and I had a wide-ranging conversation about his journeys into Tibet and Tantric Buddhism, the power of hidden lands and isolated mountain retreats, and really just a deep dive into the history and practices of Tibetan yoga. We're fortunate to have Ian offering an online course for us coming up here at Yogic Studies entitled YS110, Tibetan Yoga, Histories, Practices, Transformations. So if you enjoy this conversation and you'd like to study this material further and directly with Ian, we highly recommend that you join us. The course will run live from August 24th through September 18th, 2020. And it'll be available on demand for self-study anytime thereafter. Dr. Ian Baker is the author of several books on Himalayan and Tibetan religion and culture, including Tibetan Yoga, Principles and Practices, The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple, Tantric Wall Paintings from Tibet, and The Heart of the World, A Journey to Tibet's Lost Paradise. He received a master's degree in English literature from the University of Oxford, pursued further graduate studies in Buddhism and medical anthropology at Columbia University and University College London, and recently completed his doctorate in medical humanities at the University of Strathclyde, Scotland. He was the lead curator for the 2015-16 London exhibition, Tibet's Secret Temple, Body, Mind, and Meditation in Tantric Buddhism, and was recognized by National Geographic Society as one of 7 explorers for the millennium for his fieldwork illuminating the Tibetan tradition of hidden lands, Beyul, idealized sites of yogic practice. A favorite topic of mine, which we discuss in this episode, Ian's current research focuses on the contemporary interface of Indo-Tibetan yoga with art and science. Also something that we touch upon at the end of today's episode. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Ian Baker. All right, I'm here with Ian Baker. Ian, welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
It's really a pleasure of mine to be here too. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Where are you today? Where are you tuning in from? I'm here in Northern California. It's a sunny Friday afternoon. Where are you right now?
I'm up in the Scottish Highlands where I've been locked down for the last 4 months, very happily in the gatehouse of an old 13th century castle in the Scottish Highlands. And
Wow.
It's been a rather idyllic place to be in seclusion. And it actually ties in. It's not just arbitrary, but it does tie in with actually a lot of the research that some of which I'm sure we'll be speaking about. But wow. That's where I've been.
Well, now I wish we did have the video feed so we can see this 13th century castle in the Highlands of Scotland. That sounds rather picturesque.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Well, it's really a pleasure, you know, for so many reasons to have you on today. You know, it was really great to meet you in person at the workshop at SOAS in London. Gosh, when was that now? It feels like a lifetime ago.
It was, last November, I think. Yeah,
that's right, which was a wonderful workshop and a great opportunity to finally get to meet in person. I, of course, have been a fan, really, of your writing and your work for a number of years. And we're excited as well to have you come on Yogic Studies very soon and to offer an online course. So I look forward to getting to share a bit about the upcoming course with our listeners and community, and for an opportunity today to get to hear a bit about your story and to learn about this fascinating work that you've been doing on Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetan yoga, pilgrimage in Tibet, so many rich and interesting topics. But to get things going here, congratulations on the recent publication of your newest book, Tibetan Yoga Principles and Practices. Not only is it, I think, a important contribution just in terms of understanding the history, the doctrine, and practice of Tibetan yoga, something that we really could stand to learn so much more about, but it's also just a beautifully produced book with so much rich visual images, which is something that's really at the heart of my work. And so thanks for putting this beautiful and tantalizing book out. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this book project and how it came about for you?
Sure. So this book, which was published just last year, as you mentioned, it's highly illustrated, and the majority of the images are photographs that I've made over decades. I went first to Nepal very early on, 1977, and there's actually one or two images from that time. So this has been, even during the course of my own academic career, you could say my personal career has been very much about a personal engagement and involvement with Tibetan Tantric Buddhism, and particularly the very embodied practices and physical practices that are associated with the so-called completion phase, and which are therefore relatively less known, because those practices generally aren't traditionally introduced until one has gone through the so-called creation phase. And, you know, we'll be talking about that later, you know, in this podcast, but certainly that will be expressly talked about in the upcoming course. So what the book focuses on are the so-called completion phase practices, which are working very much with the idea of the yogic body, the energy body, and how mind and body are transformed by essentially intervening within the energy streams within the body. And so these is something I was very personally engaged with my teachers. The book is an outcome of essentially decades of personal engagement with this material. And in essence, it outlines the so-called six yogas, which are often called the six yogas of Naropa, but they were also the six yogas of the so-called completion phase, which were also transmitted by other notable teachers, including the female Mahasiddha Nyingma, who was contemporary with Naropa. And some of those are, of course, ones that are, you know, the most, let's say, popularly known, or the yoga of inner fire, Tummo, practices like that. And then the physical yogas, which are called in Tibetan the Chokor, the can be translated as illusory movements or magical movements. They're yantras that are done with the body in order to affect changes within the energy patterning of the body, which then affect, of course, consciousness itself. So anyway, that book was very long in coming. It was a work in progress. It was worked on during the course of an original MA I did at Columbia University, Bob Thurman, in Buddhist studies, and then a later degree I did in London, University College London, Medical Anthropology. And then that got sort of, project got moved into working as a curator for an exhibition at the Wellcome Collection in London on a project that was called Tibet's Secret Temple, Body, Mind, and Meditation in Tantric Buddhism. So that sort of came in between finishing my master's, my MPhil, and then the PhD. But what it involved, it allowed me to do, was to go back to Tibet on several occasions, working on film projects, more photography, and more research for the development of that particular exhibition. And rather than an exhibition catalog, we actually used my earlier published book called The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple, Tantric Wall Paintings from Tibet, in lieu of a separate exhibition catalog. But at the same time, I was working on this book, the one that you just brought up, Tibetan Yoga Principles and Practices. So a lot of the images that are used in it were created during the period of research for the exhibition itself, and were actually featured in the exhibition as objects. And so it really was enriched by being delayed as long as it was. And it's, as I said, it's an academic work on the one hand, but it's also very much a personal engagement with material and practices that have been very much part of my life ever, you know, from my first trip to Nepal in the 1970s when I was 19. So it was a long time in coming, but I think it is it's a real compendium of the so-called completion stage practices, which are the ones that encompass the specifically physical yogic practices in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition.
So it really is a compendium. And I want to, you know, get into some of these specific terms and topics and the practices of Tibetan yoga, later in this podcast. But maybe we can back up a little bit and you can tell us a little bit about your story, your background. You know, how were you first exposed to Tibetan Buddhism, to Tantric Buddhism? You know, you really have, as you've already been outlining for us, such a rich and in-depth immersion into these traditions, both as a scholar, as you've been kind of moving in and out of these different graduate programs over the decades, but also really as a practitioner, as somebody who's been a part of these living traditions. I hope you don't mind me saying so, but in some ways I've sometimes looked at you as like a modern Theos Bernard, perhaps without some of the showmanship of Theos, but the so-called white Lama of, you know, somebody, you know, born outside of the Tibetan culture and tradition, but who's was, you know, so deeply immersed in it and writing important articles and books about it. So yeah, just tell us a little bit about, you know, how were you brought into this world and how did this become your life? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it basically, let's say the Himalayas entered my life physically in my junior year of college in America. I went to a small liberal arts college, Middlebury College in Vermont, and it was traditional, as it often is, to in your third year to do a semester abroad. And rather than the usual European programs that were offered, there was suddenly this opportunity to go to Nepal, of all places. And my great passion in life at that time, besides, I was studying art history, I was studying literature, many things, and comparative religion, but I also had this deep fascination for mountains and mountaineering and rock climbing in particular. And so Nepal and the Himalayas were an immediate draw when it came about that there was an opportunity to go there, you know, when I was 19 for a semester abroad program. And within, you know, the first few weeks that I arrived in Kathmandu, this was 1977, and it was a really magical place at that time. I mean, it was before there was traffic, before earthquakes, before Maoist takeovers, et cetera, et cetera. It was really an amazing place. And I was actually at that time an art major. And so when we had to determine what we were going to do with our 1 month of that semester that was going to be independent study and focused on our particular major back in at our home universities, in my case, Middlebury College, that was going to be in, so rather than studying Tibetan painting in terms of its symbology and its I wanted to actually do it. So I decided I wanted to learn to do Tonka painting. Mm. And in that context, I was very, very fortunate in two senses. In the first being that the advisor that I had, he sent me up to his teacher, who was a great Tibetan artist living up near the sort of, you know, in view of Mount Everest up in Solokumbu. So I had this incredible opportunity to spend a month up in the high mountains at a time when that time in Nepal, there were, you know, relatively very, very few travelers and tourists. But that was when I first learned about something that then became an enduring passion of this, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, a bit later, of the hidden lands, this tradition of Beyu, which are these really the antecedents of the whole idea of Shangri-La as we've inherited that in our kind of Western 20th century consciousness of a kind of paradise, not lost, but just simply well hidden in the deepest parts of the Himalayas, and something very, very much part of the Tibetan imaginary and Tibetan myth and history. So it was in the context of my learning to paint tankas and mixing the paints and the mineral, grinding the minerals, etc. And I was more interested in, because of my passion for mountains and landscape, to know about the, rather than just, you know, the grid work in which the particular deities had to be painted, I was fascinated by the more freedom that there was in painting the mountains and the waterfalls and the glaciers and the natural landscape. And it was in that context that I first heard from my teacher then about these so-called hidden lands, and that became an enduring subject of research, which culminated in a book, you know, The Heart of the World, A Journey to the Last Secret Place. And but that was also very connected to another thing that was momentous on that first month that I was in Nepal at 19, when I met my teacher, Chatra Rinpoche, who just passed away a couple of years ago at the age of 102.
Wow.
And he was an extraordinary yogi, lama, so, you know, non-monastic, white-robed Nyingma tradition, and who had spent long periods of time in the high mountains and cave retreats, and very connected to the whole mythos, if you will, of the hidden lands, particularly through his, because, you know, again, being the non-celibate Nyingma yogin, his father-in-law was one of the great Tertons, Chulshek Lingpa, who in 1962 had tried to open one of these hidden lands on the borders between Sikkim and Bhutan, Sikkim and Nepal. And an extraordinary story that just, you know, completely captured, riveted my imagination at that time, and then led to my, trying to find out more from Chatra Rinpoche about the hidden lands. And that led to him saying to me, well, can you spend a month alone? And I said, yeah, if necessary. He goes, well, when you have a month free, please come back and I'll send you to a hidden land, and you won't have to ask me what they are. You'll find out for yourself. And that was, in a certain sense, what sort of began my whole, it's kind of my back door, if you will, into Buddhist practice. In other words, that if I was going to understand these things intellectually, I was going to have to understand them experientially first. And that, in a certain sense, has colored my whole kind of, if you will, career in anthropology, medical anthropology history, is that it's definitely been about experiential learning as much as academic study. And I've tried, as I think you sort of in your introduction sort of talk about it, sort of weaving in and out of the academic world as I, you know, disappeared for long periods of so-called field research, which was often long retreats, in caves in the Himalayas, etc. You know, in following the dictates, if you will, of Chatra Rinpoche's own guidance.
This idea of the long retreat, this is particularly common in Tibetan traditions. And something that is still, as you're saying, you know, really emphasized, that this is something that the practitioner does. Tell us a little bit about what's behind that. And, you know, so did you lived out in a cave in complete isolation for a month? How did you get food?
So in my case, and as you say, just in general, within the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis placed on lengthy retreats, and the classic one, of course, is a retreat of 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. But there are also versions of that, and there were earlier versions when they would be for periods of 100 days. They'd be period for 3 months, you know, for 1 month. Let's say, you know, very different versions. And so, in all instances, in my case, it was really just meeting a very, very charismatic teacher who immediately resonated with. From a non-monastic yogic tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, who started out by, you know, challenging me to do things that were not, something that his typical disciples were ready, willing, or able to do, just circumstantially in their lives. And so that meant him sending me increasingly for 1 month retreats at different caves in hidden lands in Nepal. And often I stayed longer than the 1 month, just simply because, you know, sort of extraordinary things started to happen in the context of those retreats. And so yeah, the tradition of long retreats in Tibetan Buddhism, the classic one is the 3 year, 3 month, 3 year, but there are also different versions of that for depending on different types of practices that need intensive focus. And that can mean the so-called creation phase practices, the preliminary practices in which one works with creative visualization, mantra, etc. And they also can work with the so-called inner yogic practices that are more like what we associate with hatha yoga and pranayama, working with the energy system of the body. And, you know, these can be undertaken in a certain sense anywhere, but somehow with Chaturamsha, because he knew my kind of passion for the high mountains, and I think he was amused by the fact that I was happy to go to some of these places that, you know, he said his own monks wouldn't go to, and to stay there. So he sent me to some of these extraordinary caves where I stayed for, you know, in one case, the first time, I think 6 weeks, and then another time was a longer retreat. But he sent me with food. I also knew after the first retreat, when he just sent me with a bag of the roasted barley flour, tsampa, which is the standard rations, if you will, in the Tibetan Buddhist world. But I'd also brought some, you know, dried vegetables, which I dried in Kathmandu on my rooftop, and had some other sort of survival foods. I had lots of spirulina and lemons by the end. That was what I was living on for the last week. But the point being is that that kind of intensive withdrawal from an isolation from the conventions of everyday life allow for a shift of vision, and therefore an energetic shift and experiential shift. That's really the point of the retreats. It's not about withdrawal from life as some kind of ultimate lifestyle choice. It's really about just the opportunity that's afforded by making that radical break with the kind of habitual tendencies and patterns of our usual lives, and just allowing practice in that sense to be something that one's able to give, you know, complete focus to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I always think of, you must be familiar with the film Samsara by Pannalin. The director,
yes.
I think.
Yep.
That beautiful opening scene where the young yogin, he's emerging out of that 3 year, 3 month, and 3 days retreat, and they have to like peel open his hands, which have been in this meditative mudra, and he's like can hardly open his eyes because of the dust that's gathered over his eyes and these big matted dreadlocks, and
right.
But then the film begins, and he has to then reintegrate into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as hard as a isolated retreat for 3 years could be, as the, you know, the whole core of the film is that it's the entering back into samsara. That's, you know, the finding that balance, right? That can be the real test.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why I think different teachers emphasize different ways of practicing. So for example, I was very, very committed to the whole Tibetan Buddhist path, particularly when I went back to Nepal, you know, in my, this was mid-20s then, and decided that's where I wanted to be, that's where I wanted to live. And after that first retreat, when I told Chaturamsha that, you know, I had to go back and kind of work in the world, I was running an American academic study program in Kathmandu at that time. He said, and I said, I can't be a monk in this life. And he said, why would you want to be a monk? And I sort of found that it was very interesting. And I said, well, wouldn't that be the ideal way to practice? He goes, no, not for you. And so this was very, very interesting for me in that, you know, why I found that in my own personal experience, the student-teacher relationship was so important, because it allowed for that relationship and teaching to happen outside, you could say, of the kind of by the book tradition, but rather on an oral basis by which, you know, the teacher will teach according to the experiential signs that the student shows And it might be very, very different from one student to another. And that's what really allowed me and certainly inspired me to go as deeply as I did into the tradition, because I certainly experienced with Chöntö Rinpoché that somehow or other he just always knew exactly where to challenge me, where to push me, where to and where to undermine any of my preconceptions about what the practice should be and how one should practice.
Now, you mentioned that Chöntö Rinpoché is from the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And for, you know, our listeners, you know, probably are aware as one of the four main schools and often considered the oldest school of Tibetan Buddhism. And would you say that the practices that he was providing to you, the tradition that you were being exposed to, were kind of specific to this Nyingma style, or these things that are kind of shared more broadly across Tibetan Buddhist camps?
So just in general, again, for people who don't have that historical background in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, as you said, there were the sort of four main schools, and the Nyingma, literally meaning the ancient ones or the old ones, were retroactively designated as the school of the elders, in the sense that these represented teachings that were first brought to Tibet in the 8th century by Padmasambhava, who was a so-called Indian Mahasiddha, but from the area that we now of Udayana, which was a legendary kingdom where the Buddhist tantras were said to have emerged somewhere sort of along the ancient Silk Road north of Gandhara in what's now thought to be the Swat Valley in Pakistan. But at that time was a extraordinary world in which Eastern and Western traditions actually came into kind of a radical confluence because of this being also on the trade route. But in any case, so Padmasambhava coming to Tibet in the 8th century was able to introduce these yogic practices of the Tantric Buddhist path that had been developed in Udayana, where he was from, also merging and adapting with pre-existing Bön, you could say almost shamanistic practices in Tibet itself. So there was a kind of a creative synthesis between indigenous Tibetan Bön traditions and the yogic traditions from this land of Udayana on the Silk Road, essentially. And what was also very interesting here is that, Padmasambhava taught the king in a very different way than he established in Tibet, and I think this is very important for the overall subject of understanding what Tibetan yoga is. He established two orders in Tibet, which were to be equally valued. One was the red ordination, the monks, and the other was the white robed ordination. Those who would, unlike the monks, would never cut their hair. They kept their hair long. They wore ornaments and white-robed as opposed to red-robed. So these were the yogic path, and you could say the monastic, more clerical path of Tibetan, what became Tibetan Buddhism. There was both Tantric Buddhism, but it was the yogic path, the white-robed path that Padmasambhava himself represented, and in the sense that he was a non-celibate, non-monastic yogic practitioner, and whose teachings in Tibet were transmitted through over subsequent centuries through what were called ter, or treasures that were revealed by his later followers. And these developed in parallel to the subsequent schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the Kagyu, the Sakya, and the Gelugpa, all of which had yogic practices as well, very much so. But the Nyingma was the one that somehow or other, just karmically or however we want to look at it, I found most resonant for myself, particularly because it was a non-monastic approach of based upon the concept of sort of integration with samsara rather than renunciation of samsara.
Yeah, that's really, really fascinating, and perhaps something we can come back to later, this difference between monastic and non-monastic traditions, and thinking about, you know, householder yogis when we kind of get it more into some of these practices. But just to continue now with your story a bit, you know, you're saying how Rinpoche introduced you, or perhaps you had already been exposed to this idea of the Beyul and these hidden lands, which culminated in this memoir that you wrote, The Heart of the World, A Journey to Tibet's Lost Paradise. And I think I told you this when we first met in person, but I was first introduced to this book in college when one of my undergrad professors said to me outside of class, "You have to read this book. This is one of the most incredible books I've ever read. It will change your life." And this is a professor who I have great respect for. So you take those words very seriously. And I can remember just devouring this book. And it's a very powerful kind of classic spiritual memoir of the pilgrimage. But it's also, I think, one of the more lucid, you know, kind of accounts of the theory and practice of Tantric and Tibetan Buddhism, but weaved together with your own narrative and this incredible hunt, this pilgrimage for these hidden lands. It's this great kind of Indiana Jones adventure story too. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what is at the heart of the world, and what are these Beyul or hidden lands?
Okay. Well, as I said, it goes back to the very first trip that I made to Nepal in 1977 when I was studying Tangka painting, or the traditional scroll painting tradition of Tibet, and through which I learned that some of these extraordinary landscapes that are painted as the background and the context for particular Tantric Buddhist deities that are being depicted by the artists were... And I spoke to my teacher at that time. He said, "Well, these are not just sort of imaginary places. Such kind of magical places really do exist. And but they're so difficult to reach. They're hidden behind these high walls of ice and rock. And, you know, ordinary beings can't really get there." So of course that, you know, as a coming from a mountaineering and rock climbing background, and being only 19 years old, that was an amazing challenge and something very exciting to me to even contemplate that there would be sort of these magical paradisical valleys hidden away in remote parts of the Himalayas that, you know, you could only get to if you had some degree of kind of yogic or mountaineering skills. And so it was in that context that I then went to ask Chatra Rinpoche about them. When I asked him about the hidden lands, because it was really something that deeply inspired my imagination at that time. And I think he was very, and I stayed that first time in retreat. He said, "Stay for a month." But because the experience became so rich and the meditative experiences began, the nyam, as it was called, the experiences that arise through meditation were so extraordinary for me that I didn't want to leave after a month. So I stayed an additional week, even though I'd basically run out of food. So I sort of fasted this last week and then came down. But I think this... and then I explained to him the reason I stayed was because, you know, the sort of strange visionary phenomena, et cetera. And he quizzed me on that very strongly. And, but as a result of that, he said, he wrote down on a paper in this beautiful calligraphy that he had, the seven different hidden lands, you know, which were in Nepal at that time, saying, you know, to go to all of these and to spend a month in them. And, so that sort of became my path, as it were, these pilgrimages to remote wild places in Himalayas and to stay there and doing intensive practices that he gave me for each of them that was different, meditative, yogic practices. And so that became, and then ultimately when the opportunity came to travel to the greatest of these so-called hidden lands, which was called Pemaku, the hidden land arrayed like a lotus, which was in the southeastern part of Tibet along the borders with Assam, Arunachal Pradesh, that was my introduction. This is considered the greatest of all these so-called hidden lands. And that began a series of expeditions that I then made over the subsequent several years, going yearly. to Panmanjaro.
And didn't at some point you actually had an audience and consulted with His Holiness the Dalai Lama about this particular Beul?
Yeah, actually with the Dalai Lama, I consulted prior to my first retreat. I guess it was, I had the opportunity, at that time I was meeting with the Dalai Lama every year because of the student programs that I started running in Nepal. This is before His Holiness won the Nobel Peace Prize, so there was greater accessibility in those days. And I always was able to arrange a private audience with His Holiness after I would bring the group of students to meet him. And that allowed me to talk with him about, you know, personal practice, for example. And on one of those occasions, I was taking, as it was called even then, a sabbatical, 6 months off from my work with that academic program, as I was academic director of. And, I'd been meeting him over the previous couple of years, and I said, I wanted to do this, use this time to go and do an intensive practice in one of these so-called hidden lands, and described it to him, and he recognized it from the text. And he said, well, this is a very wild, you know, place. How, you know, can you go there? I said, no, it's not a problem. And what I wanted to get his advice. I said, you know, what would be the most what would be the most effective practice, in other words, that I could get the most results in the shortest amount of time. So that began, you know, it was a whole nother sort of adventure in the understanding of these places, not just as wild, remote sanctuaries in the Himalayas in times of strife or need as they functioned historically, but as places for intensive practice where, as the texts describe, at least, you know, what you to meditate in these places, you achieve, you know, in a month what would take 3 years elsewhere. And that's at least how the tradition sort of understands it. And that was also on the basis in which I visited these places. I always went, you know, within the cultural constructs of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And so I went there and performed the practices, the rituals, et cetera, that are prescribed. But all of that led to this series of expeditions then into the so-called greatest of these hidden lands, Pemaku. And that's really what the book, The Heart of the World, originally titled A Journey to the Last Secret Place, and then retitled in the paperback edition, A Journey to Tibet's Lost Paradise, which essentially is what it represents in the Tibetan history and consciousness.
And is the idea that, you know, one can do these practices anywhere, right? You don't need to go anywhere. You can kind of traverse these internal landscapes of the mind, just sitting right at home, listening to this podcast. Mm-hmm. But that there are particular environments that are particularly charged or enhanced, or that aid one's physical and mental capacities to kind of expand their mind and awareness more readily, more quickly. That there's certain conditions and environments that aid one's yogic practice. Is that fair to say?
Very, very much. And in the Tibetan word that's used often is ne. So ne translates literally just as place, but it means a vital place. It means a charged place, a sacred place, or a power place. I mean, there are various ways in which we try to approximate the meaning using English translation or English words to translate it. And so a hidden land in itself, a beul, is a type of ne, what they would call a ne chempo, or a great ne, a great power place. And the idea is that the elements, I mean, all of the hidden lands and the nays are described as having so-called qi ni sang yang sang, so outer, inner, secret, and innermost secret dimensions to them, which really refer to the types of experiences or the perception of that environment by the pilgrim, by the yogin who visits that site, either simply as a pilgrim or as a practitioner, or as a yogin. And the outer, and the idea is that the elements, that are signified at least by the outer elements of earth, water, fire, air, space, are somehow intensified in these so-called ne, in these power places, and therefore, by practicing there, the intensity and power of the outer elements in nature supports the transformation and purification of those same elemental processes and forces within one's own body mind. And so on the outer, on the innermost level, there's a kind of conflation, emerging of the outer and the inner, so that the so-called divisions that we normally would perceive between a physical environment and the kind of continuum of enlightened awareness sort of become porous. And there's this whole sense of the outer and the inner become a single continuum. And that's where the way in which we engage with the landscape and with the power place becomes itself a practice. And that's done, you know, in a variety of ways, just in the way that one engages. It can happen on the outer level just simply through ritual, but most importantly, ultimately, is a sort of shift in awareness and perception that allows for a different engagement with what we normally would consider to be external phenomena, but we start to recognize as being just a display of awareness.
A lot of these sites have waterfalls. Is that right? What is the significance of the waterfall at one of these sacred sites?
Mm-hmm. Well, the waterfalls have great symbolism. And is actually, and when we go back to that very kind of first experience I had when I was learning to paint Tibetan scroll paintings when I was 19, I was very intrigued by the symbolism of the waterfalls, because they would sort of show these waterfalls pouring down from mountains that just seemed, you know, they were snow-capped, but I was wondering where all that water came from. And often you'd see depicted in the scroll paintings a kind of cave or a tunnel behind the waterfalls. And this is actually how it was first pointed out to me by Kapa Kaldan, who was my painting teacher. He said, well, those are the gateways to the Bayou. Those are the gateways to the hidden land. And it's the veil of water that you have to get behind. And again, it was both figurative and literal at the same time, because the veil of water on the one hand is this idea that everything's shifting moment to moment. And just like Heraclitus says, you can't step into the same water twice. The same is dramatically true in a waterfall. But at the same time, in these texts that describe the hidden lands, there are many instances, both in the textual and the oral tradition, that the passage through a waterfall is what occasions that shift in consciousness that suddenly allows one to kind of enter into that, if we use our own kind of modern terms for it, a kind of Shangri-La encounter, or Shambhala, this idea of a non-ordinary, transformative, and transformed reality. So literally the portal into that is often the passage through a waterfall.
So shifting a little bit now to the book, but more specifically to some of the particular practices that you outline, you know, in the text, and that I think are also core to your own experience and training in these traditions. In the opening of the book, you write, quote, "The yogic practices at the core of Vajrayana Buddhism are further endangered by conventions of secrecy that have traditionally made them inaccessible to anyone not in a mentorial relationship with an accomplished master." And you've kind of been describing what that has sort of looked like in your case. And I've heard elsewhere you've mentioned that, again, it was the Dalai Lama actually who suggested to you, and he said this on other accounts as well, that this really is the time to bring these teachings out of secrecy. So can you speak to that a little bit, the nature of secrecy of these teachings and practices, and why you felt really compelled to write this book and to bring this to light?
Sure. Well, it goes back really to the earlier book that I did called that was given the title The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple, Tantric Wall Paintings from Tibet. And that is a book based upon mural paintings in a late 17th century temple behind the Potala Palace in Lhasa that was a private meditation chamber for the sixth Dalai Lama, Sangyang Gyatso. And they are extraordinary images that are illustrating really the only place it's known to do so on wall paintings, at least in Tibet, the physical yogic practices, a lot of the visionary practices that are generally and traditionally considered to be quite secret. And also,
if I can just jump in for a second, the paintings are just phenomenal and truly unique, I think, and really portray this very complex and dynamic physical and even postural yoga practice. So I do hope we can get into that a little bit. And I know that this will be something you'll cover in the upcoming course as well.
Well, what's really interesting about these paintings is that they were really described, even by the Dalai Lama himself, as a visual guide of the path to enlightenment, according to the most, you could say, esoteric, advanced, and accelerated practices within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And in other words, that they didn't rely upon the kind of customary monastic ritual, village-based rituals, et cetera, or long drawn out so-called creation phase practices based on creative visualization mantra, but they really go right to the energetic practices that work with the yogic body. So these were often considered secret for a variety of reasons, and that was a conversation I had not just with His Holiness Dalai Lama, but others. But the Dalai Lama very specifically said, the time of secrecy is over. There was a reason for it in the past, because he said literally some of these practices, because they stir up so much energy, if they were undertaken by people without proper preparation, it would lead to disturbances, not just psychological or physiological disturbances, but even within a monastic community, it could sort of be disruptive. Whereas, of course, the point of the practice is to be creatively disruptive of the kind of status quo, as it were, of our body mind. But this idea of secrecy is, on the one hand, because they can also be misunderstood and misapplied outside of the framework, which is fundamental to all of Tibetan Buddhism, of a commitment to wisdom and compassion and ethical behavior, because some of them can be seen as being transgressive in a variety of ways. It's very important that there be a very thorough and understanding of the very basis of what Tantra is, for example, before engaging in these very, very volatizing practices that really can stir up energy and are designed to do so, but very, very important that energy then is kind of processed and integrated, and not, within the Buddhist context, the view of shunyata, of emptiness, meaning a kind of state in which exalted states are not co-opted by egoic consciousness, but are rather dissolved into a state of transpersonal awareness. So just in a kind of simplistic way, that would be one way to understand the idea of keeping these practices secret until a student or a practitioner was ready, and then it would be up to the teacher to decide when should occur. And then the instructions were often what were called the whispered lineage. And so even though there are, of course, texts that describe all these practices, these were always augmented and contextualized by the oral teachings that would always be given from the teacher to the student, optimally in a kind of one-to-one context.
Yeah, as you're speaking, the thought occurred to me that it's also just an interesting situation today in kind of lieu of some of these debates and attacks about cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. And the Tibetan case is interesting because of the history, the politics, the Chinese, occupation of Tibet, where it really is true that the Tibetan culture and civilization has been under threat, is endangered. And if there are not stewards of the tradition, if there are not practitioners, scholars, historians, you name it, if the teaching of the Tibetan language is not continued to carry out, there is this threat of kind of an endangered culture, an endangered species of being lost. Mm-hmm. And you have, really important lamas and figures who really are trying to bring these teachings, out from hiding, as it were, out from the caves, out of the secrecy. Do you think that that's also an important part of it, like for the Dalai Lama, who really is now trying to preserve Tibetan culture?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think, as you say, part of it is preservation and part of it is the recognition that when outer circumstances change, that the ways in which transmission occurs of these kinds of practices, those also have to change. And, you know, to go back, though, first to this issue of cultural appropriation, you know, it's such a complicated concept, because if we were talking about cultural appropriation, you know, we would have to fault, you know, the Romans for introducing elements of Greek art. We'd have to then criticize, you know, the Mycenaeans in Greece for appropriating Minoan art and traditions and ritual forms. And the same way Tibetan Buddhism itself could be seen as a cultural appropriation of Indian tantric Vajrayana culture. So the point, I think, is that cultures are enriched immensely by the kinds of mutual borrowings and sharings and that have occurred from the earliest times of human history. But so it's not so much it's what happens in that process. If there's something where that's lost or, you know, misconstrued, that can be problematic. But the fact is, I think that cultures, just like Tibet being a prime example, completely transformed, you could say, from in its pre-Buddhist phase, but by importing appropriating a foreign religion, just as Europe did with Middle Eastern, you know, Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah, so I mean, one could read the entire history of Buddhism and Buddhisms as a story of cultural appropriation. You know, we have Chinese Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism. You could say they're all appropriating from this, you know, this Indian Buddhism.
Exactly.
But that phrase misses, I think it because it's charged today with particular meanings, it actually kind of mislabels cultural processes of interaction and borrowing and enhancing, as you said. So I think that's true.
Yeah, but I think that what you're mostly, you know, addressing there, and which is the important part, is that as many lamas have said, and I think increasingly the recognition that some of the core and most precious teachings and practices within Tibetan Buddhism are kind of endangered, in the sense that because they've been transmitted so cautiously that there are very few in reality who know them and therefore who are transmitting them. And yet at the same time, there's extraordinary interest in the Western world in these kind of embodied physical practices, you know, which Hatha Yoga represents. And so in some ways, it's ironic that it's the Hatha Yoga component of Tibetan Buddhism that has been kept the most guarded, when in reality we see in the West today Hatha Yoga sort of taught in, you know, almost every town there'll be Hatha Yoga classes. So we're in a very different kind of cultural context. And I think the other thing that I think is very interesting, and I think that's something that Jim Mallinson spoke to in his course on the Amrita Siddhi. We also see that in some of the earliest examples of so-called physical yoga, Chokor, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is that the colophons in some of these texts were anything but secret. So they were saying, you know, that these practices should be transmitted widely for beginners and advanced practitioners alike. They will benefit everybody. And so that we actually see that the culture, and this is widely held now by many scholars within the Tibetan community itself, as well as out, is that the secrecy that developed was through a process in which the monastic establishment had to kind of repossess tantric Buddhism, which essentially had been an outgrowth from an excessively monastic transmission. And so that secrecy had to occur because there was a disconnect between many of the ways in which the tantric yogas would be practiced and the Vinaya vows within the monastic communities. And so secrecy was, unfortunately, often resulted in even some of the things we see in some of the so-called scandals within, you know, of course, all religious communities, but within the Tibetan Buddhist world, comes from a kind of disconnect between actual practice and what's sort of claimed on, you know, from within the tradition. And so this is an issue of transparency. You know, secrecy and transparency don't go well together. So in an age when transparency is increasingly important and emphasized in all fields of knowledge, it's very hard to see a legitimate place. And it's exactly what this one said. Rather than secrecy, what we need are very, very detailed and comprehensive explanations. And that was actually, I had no intention to actually ever make that original book on the Dalai Lama's Secret Temple. It was really at his request. And he said, you know, and I said, well, what are there things I should keep out? He said, no, make it as, he said, the biggest mistake for the most misunderstandings in Tibetan Buddhism come from explaining things halfway. So he asked me to kind of be as thorough as I could. So that, I think, is something that, yeah, and that's why I think where the academic world today offers so much, because of its deep commitment to analyzing the text, to working, you know, in an anthropological context, with an ethnographic context, where we can really get to the into the depth of a tradition that had been for a long time trying to negotiate a kind of a public positioning and a kind of secret esoteric path simultaneously. And a lot of that has led to historical as well as contemporary confrontation problems, let's say.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking to the contributions of the academic community and scholarship on these subjects, you know, as you and our listeners know, we've learned so much about the history of physical yoga over the last, you know, decade or so, and particularly these last 5 years with the Hatha Yoga Project. But still, you know, much of the history of physical or Hatha Yoga, you know, the story is told from within India, and particularly, you know, Hindu Hatha Yoga traditions. One of the surprising kind of finds of the Hatha Yoga Project, as you know, is this deep analysis of the Amrita Siddhi, which is this sort of kind of like a hybrid Buddhist Shaiva, but perhaps, you know, more Buddhist, more Vajrayana than anything else, as this 11th century text, one of the first to, or the first to teach some of these mudras or bodily seals and other physical aspects of yoga, and kind of using some of the terminology that would become paramount for later Hatha Yoga traditions. And the identification of this as more of a Buddhist text than anything else. But yet after that, then kind of the rest of the history of Hatha Yoga as we know it, as it's often taught, as the history reveals, is all taught on the Indian side. And I think this is where your work is for a history of yoga is so exciting, because it fills in this huge gap of what continued to happen and flourish in Tibet. And so what do you make? I mean, this is a big question, and it's very complex, and we could spend, you know, many podcasts discussing all of this. But what is your take on, you know, what is the relationship between the more well-known Hatha Yoga systems of India, and then what was developing in Tibet and the Tibetan yoga that you're studying and practicing?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is from, and this is from Jason Birch from the Hatha Yoga Project, is that the first evidence of the use of the word Hatha in, let's say, the, you know, any kind of yogic context seems to be in the 18th chapter of the Guhya Samaja Tantra, which is a Buddhist tantra dating roughly from the 6th century, in which the word Hatha is referring to a forceful movement, although it's not clarified what that movement is, unlike the Amrita Siddhi, where we know what the movements are, but that was already several centuries later. But it's referring to a particular kind of forceful Hatha movement, or a gesture, or a mudra, we don't know, in order to induce what are we're called empty forms. So certain kind of visionary phenomena. So, you know, whether it was pressing on the eyes, whether it was pressing, you know, an Uddiyata Bandha to alter energy flow, we don't know, but it was very much associated with yogic vision, but through a forceful means to alter a state of consciousness, if you will. So we see already that even in the Sanskrit sources, that's already a Tibetan, or it's not Tibetan, in Indian Buddhist context, Dogya Samaja, which is generally considered to be the first of the so-called great, or certainly the most well-known Buddhist tantras. So the Guhya Samaja, literally meaning the Guhya, secret assembly, Samaja. So this was the first really tantric Buddhist deity depicted, still depicted in a full lotus posture, but in a yabhyum form and united with a consort, multiple arms, multiple heads, a radical practice that also involved certain practices of sexual yoga, certain kinds of working with the channels, but not with, as far as we're aware, the same kind of yogic movements that we associate with some of the later hatha yoga, certainly in India, but then also some of the, probably the next most prominent of the Buddhist tantras, the Hevajra, which is generally dated to late 9th century. That has a very specific set of 32 movements that are done forward, backward, and then mixed. So basically a sequential breath-based vinyasa, essentially, but dating back from, well, you know, around, Hevajra seems to be dated differently by different scholars, but let's say probably no later than around 900. So we already, and of course it was, there were different versions of it, but we still see a very much a continuing tradition in which physical yoga, as we would know it in the Indian tradition today, was very much part of it. And again, we see from the 12th century very clear evidence that, so let's say within 100-year period of the Amrita Siddhi, we see already a set of movements that were of 18, I think it was, of Padmadrupa in Tibet. We have already sequential yogic postural movements done with held breath, that, you know, in certain sense proceed, as far as I'm aware now. I mean, of course, there's been developments ongoing with the Hatha Yoga project to see when is the real first evidence of a so-called kind of sequential set of movements in the Hatha Yoga tradition in India. But certainly from the 12th century, we see it in the Padmadrupa tradition. We see it in another tradition called the Yutuk Nintik, which was also from the 12th century. And that was a set of 18 yogic movements that were designed for non-celibate Tibetan doctor, medical practitioners who needed to actually gain results as quickly as possible because they had to devote the rest of their time to treating the ill and the infirm. So we see a very dynamic practice from the 12th century of working with the energy body through physical practices. So we can see a lot of, and then with the Lukong, so with the sixth Dalai Lama's private meditation chamber, which the Dalai Lama Sacred Temple, there's a set of 23 movements there, which were painted at the end of the 17th century, but they are painted from a text that dates to the 15th century of Pema Lingpa, who was a Bhutanese so-called treasure revealer, but who transmitted this particular set of dynamic breath-based movements. So we see really this early history within the Tibet, within the tantric Buddhist tradition of physical practice that we would associate with hatha yoga movements, certainly not just with asana as a seated pose that could be held comfortably for long periods. Sometimes asana is understood, but certainly very dynamic forms of pranayama combined with vigorous, more kriya style movements. So I think this is something that, you know, has been exciting for me to experience through the work that's being done with the Hatha Yoga Project, and, you know, to begin to see how there were actually the things that we associate more typically with Hatha Yoga were very present in tantric Buddhism long before we sort of see them in a classical kind of Hindu context.
Yeah, I'm wondering here, because it seems like, and I remember from your presentation at SOAS and you know, from reading your published work, I mean, there really is such a documented, continuous record in texts and then later in these wall paintings of these type of physical and dynamic movement-based, breath-based yogas, is one of the issues in terms of why this has not been really reconciled with the broader kind of Hindu and Shaiva Tantra, Hatha Yoga narratives. Is it an issue of terminology? Because, you know, we're kind of looking at these things expecting to see the terms asana or pranayama and Hatha Yoga, mm-hmm. or even yoga. And there's different terms in Tibetan terminology that's being used. Or is it also that this is new work? These are new findings that have come out. Some of your own work, are these things that had been glossed over or not looked at from the broader history of yoga perspective?
Yeah, I mean it's a very, very important question, and you know, I'd love to be a whole conference on that alone would be wonderful, because you know, in a certain sense, the proprietary rights to Hatha Yoga in India, we see that, you know, as a form of Indian nationalism. It's also, you know, that crosses over into the academic world, where it's almost inconvenient to see parallels that are too close within, you know, whether it's certain forms of Taoist Qigong, which are also dynamic, breath-based, sequential movements that in many ways are we see reflections of that within Indian Hatha Yoga. But there's been so much transformation of the practices. And the other thing I think that slightly complicates it, because we have a very firm record, certainly, let's say, in these wall paintings from the late 17th century, which are from a very specific text, which is actually was known to exist 200 years before that, and which is inscriptions are on the wall as well, showing a sequence of 23 movements. So there's just no doubt that at that time, in the greater end. But we also see the direct antecedents of that particular text from the 15th century, which was Pema Lingpa, his so-called earlier incarnation, Longchenpa, 14th century. We also have texts, what's called the Wish Fulfilling Gem, I think, where he also outlines a very, again, a similarly dynamic, breath-based, sequential, yogic movements, and you know, from the fourth. So I think it's really important to begin to, first of all, establish the authenticity of the dating of those texts. So, because we know that so many, even whether it's the Vajratantra, there are different versions of it that sort of start to appear over time, and you know, were certain aspects added, were certain things left out. Those are important to determine. But I think certain rigorous work like that's been done, you know, in the context of the Amrita Siddhi, to see how that may have kind of also evolved, changed over time. But by correlating that with parallel developments within the so-called Tibetan Buddhist world, a lot of those texts, of course, have Sanskrit original texts, but some of them were composed and produced within Tibet itself. So I think it's really important to kind of create a timeline to begin to look at where certain almost paradigmatic movements which we can see within both traditions. Almost a kind of a genealogy of asana, if you will.
It seems, around 11th or 12th century, you know, it was a really significant time period. And it's also when we start to see the demise of forms of Buddhism in India, and then they are really flourishing outside of India and in places like Tibet and Nepal. And it's around that time that these Shaiva and Vaishnava Hatha Yoga traditions start, at least the texts start to be codified more. Mm-hmm. So where that story starts to pick up more, and the more familiar asana names, you know, and by the time we get to the 15th century and Svatmarama's Hatha Pradipika. So it seems as if during that same time, there was this great flourishing in Tibet, but it's really kind of its own stream and its own branch of physical yoga that, you know, naturally, you know, in the Tibetan context and language is using its own terminology and idioms and language, but that very similar types of really rigorous and dynamic mind-body practices were flourishing.
Yes, very much so. And I think it's exactly as you say. I mean, there was the great Himalayan divide in between. So a lot of these traditions did develop independently, but there was also the cross-fertilization that occurred at, I think, a particularly dynamic and periods. One would think that the two traditions naturally would have co-evolved.
And one of the great crossovers for me that's always fascinated me are these Mahasiddha, these great, you know, tantric yogins, and these great siddhas who cross over these boundaries of Buddhism and Shaivism, who show up on these, you know, 84 siddha lists in Tibetan works, in Sanskrit works, who are well known from South India all the way up into the Himalayas. This has always been this really interesting link of these siddhas, these that almost fly over, you know, these disciplinary and religious boundaries.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the course that's coming up on Tibetan yoga on these subjects, where we'll be able to dive into this material in even more depth and kind of in a more structured way, really go through all of this rich history, doctrine, and practice. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the course and what students might be able to expect, and who might be interested in a course like this?
Okay. Well, there'll be four modules, and to sort of outline them in brief first, and then I'll go back and do so in greater depth. It's really looking at the whole course, if you will, of physical practices that they developed within the Tibetan tradition, and as they interacted with and interfaced with what we understand to be tantric Buddhism in India itself. So the first module will be focusing on history and using the illustrations in the Lukang temple, in the Dalai Lama's secret temple, which, as I mentioned, the Dalai Lama himself referred to it as a kind of visual encyclopedia or a visual guide of the path to enlightenment. But it has actually, as you said, one whole mural is devoted to the 84 Mahasiddhas. So we see the whole kind of historical development of the ways in which these very, very charismatic figures introduced very dynamic practices into the corpus of tantric Buddhism, which didn't exist per se within the monastic tradition prior to their emergence and activities between the 8th and the 12th century. So the first module will be looking largely at the history and development of these practices, and also in brief about how these kinds of practices first were introduced into the Western, you could say, literature and imagination from the early 20th century. But that's going to come more in the fourth module. But I think it's important to look at that to understand, you know, what do we even mean by Tibetan yoga? What does yoga mean in the Tibetan world in a way that might have a slightly different context or meaning within than it does, let's say, in a kind of classical or contemporary Indian context? Then the second module is going to focus specifically on the so-called completion phase yogas, naljur, as they're called in Tibetan. So naljur means literally union with the natural state. So it's the state of unification, but the natural state referring to a state of being, which in a way is transcendent of all of our kind of habitual distortions and delusions and et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to look at the physical practices, the so-called trukor movements, the tsalung, which is really the tsa meaning the nadis, the meridians, and the lung meaning the prana. So looking at the practices of basically prana, nadi, bindu, and that very dynamic physical yogas as a prelude to the so-called six inner yogas of the completion phase, which start out with tummo, the yoga of inner heat, which is described as the pillar of the path. That's supported by as an auxiliary practices involved with consort practice. That leads to clear light practices, the clear light yogas, then working. And these are sort of ascending up through the central axis of the the yogic body in terms of the locus of focus for these practices, because then you have the clear light yogas focused on the heart center, then the dream yogas, which are often located just even through the practice itself at the throat, and then the ejection of consciousness through the fontanella at the crown of the head, poa, which is the sort of yoga that leads to the sixth yoga of the bardo, which is an intermediary dimension between life, life, death, and a postulated further incarnation, and how one navigates. But on a more subtle level, is how one navigates these kind of transitional states that might arise in other ways, in other contexts. So that second module will be kind of really going into depth about what lies behind these six yogas, the way they're practiced, but as importantly, to contextualize them in ways that perhaps haven't been done in some of the more popular depictions of them that we've inherited historically from the 1920s on up to the contemporary works. So trying to look at these so-called practices in depth as much as can be done in 90 minutes. And then the third component is looking at what's called in Tibetan Dzogchen. It's a direct translation of, well, it means total perfection, great perfection. It's the yoga, it's the supreme yoga. It's translated also from the Sanskrit Ati Yoga. So Ati meaning the supreme, the unexcellable. And this is a yoga that also uses, interestingly, even though in a certain sense it dispenses with all of the so-called supportive practices that we associate with the earlier phases of the path, it also has very dynamic physical practice involved with it, very dynamic isometric exercises, balancing poses, held postures that are almost more like yin yoga, all of which are designed to move the energy through the subtle body in order to induce visionary as well as just kind of clear light states of consciousness associated with the goals of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, and what's often also called known as Mahamudra. So we'll be looking at this more sort of subtle level of embodied physical practices as they express themselves in so-called Dzogchen, which is the outcome, if you will, of the earlier phases of practice that in which the more dynamically physical practices are present. And then in the fourth component, really going to look at, I think, some really interesting pioneering work that's beginning to emerge in looking at the scientific study of these yogic practices in the West, and that sort of beginning in the 1980s with Herbert Benson from Harvard, who came over and studied yogis, you know, at the recommendation of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, of studying, you know, the practice of inner fire, of tummo.
Yeah, what is it, the relaxation response or something? Yeah,
yes, exactly. So the part of the outcome of that was looking at the relaxation response. But he was sort of a pioneer in looking at some of this material. And there's some interesting kind of even video clips, which I'll try to include from that very, very kind of foundational work that he began to do. But a lot of that, of course, has been advanced so much further by neuroscientists today working with female tummo practitioners in Eastern Tibet, and the great interest that's happening in Bhutan in a way of trying to sort of legitimize these archaic practices by looking at the ways in which science can validate or at least enrich an understanding of the kinds of, you know, what are the effects these practices are having, how, to what degree are they measurable, and what degree do those measurability have meaning in terms of the subjective experience. And there's a lot of interest, and this has come from work that I've been doing in Bhutan in the context of these annual Vajrayana Buddhism conferences, where Bhutan has expressed increasing interest to have a kind of science dialogue with their own traditional practitioners. So we've been trying to set up, and we did some pioneering work at first with being able to measure some of these advanced practitioners, whether of Dzogchen, of just completely sort of non-conceptual meditation, as well as those doing dynamic tummo practice to look at, you know, endorphin levels, looking at different ways of understanding the subtle body through the recent research that's been done with the so-called interstitium, which is a been identified by some as a kind of a new organ in the body that works on a different electrical current, so-called physioelectricity, and which seems, because it permeates all structures in the body, seems to help to account for why acupuncture works, why meridians might exist, and what can we learn from that contemporary research in Western biomedicine to learn how can that kind of system, if all, you know, can be optimized, and to what relation that might have with the so-called yogic body, particularly the Shushumna, the Avaduti, these kind of structures that are posited as part of a human anatomy, but which are, of course, on another level, metaphysical.
Yeah, well, this is a really fascinating area of contemporary research, and could be a rich topic maybe for another podcast, or even a whole other course that maybe we could conjure up sometime. It's a fascinating interest of mine as well. I remember reading years ago, actually, some of the some publications and books from the Mind and Life Society, headed by the Dalai Lama, and this convergence of Buddhist traditions and practitioners with modern, Western scientists, neurologists, psychologists, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it's such an important, a timely and rich exchange of knowledge systems. Mm-hmm. So I'm really thrilled that you're going to include some of that material in the course, and that you yourself are really at the forefront of helping to pioneer some of this research. I didn't know that about what you were doing in Bhutan. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. No, I think in Bhutan, is of course, it's a living tradition where this tantric Buddhist tradition is sort of a state religion. And so it's very, very interesting to see, you know, the whole country and the king, you know, His Majesty the King himself, you know, very much engaged with this idea of how their own traditions can be not validated, but to be understood within a different framework with different vocabulary, and perhaps even enhancing the power of the practices by the kind of understanding we might begin to have of the energy body as it's now being.
And how it contribute to our what is it? Gross domestic happiness, right?
Yes, that's the that's the Bhutanese model of success. Yes, exactly.
I love it. Yeah. Well, we're kind of coming to the end of our time here and winding down. There was one more, just a short quote from your book that I wanted to read, and maybe you could just speak to a little bit, and this might be a way to kind of wrap things up.
Sure.
You write, this is from the recent Tibetan Yoga. You write, "Tibetan yoga's core aim is to transform the human condition, freeing it from disempowering struggle and discontent, and awakening self-transcendent empathy and compassionate action." And this really jumped out at me, that the result of this yoga, not only to transform the individual human condition, to remove suffering for oneself, but to awaken this self-transcendent empathy and compassionate action. And this has always struck me as, you know, perhaps one of the unique differences between Hindu and Buddhist yogas, and this maybe this kind of bodhicitta ingredient of the bodhisattva. And do you think that this is something unique about Tibetan yoga, and that the result is not just this kind of individual blast off moksha or samadhi, but what is the role of empathy and compassionate action at the end of this?
Yeah. Well, just in brief, because it's certainly, as you know, in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, but Buddhism generally, there's a great emphasis placed on metta, originally loving kindness, karuna, compassion. And it's something that is held to be a direct experience that arises from this fundamental insight into the, you could say, the self-transcendent nature of reality, or emptiness, shunyata, that in a sense, rather than an exalting of the self and experience, it's a rather a experience in which, as that self is allowed to dissolve as an egoic structure, this spiritual reality emerges, which is poorly translated as emptiness, because the word being shunyata is equally a plenitude, and it's essentially, it's this primordial, you know, it's the infinite potential from which everything arises. But there experientially within that state is a state, you could say, of, well, at least as the Tibetan Buddhist tradition would look at it, this is the state of bliss, this mahasukha. When purified, it's objectless. So of course, as we know, Buddhism is often a kind of, you know, the critique of desire. But bliss itself has no object, and therefore it's a state of absolute, you could say, on one hand, a kind of a rapture, that when it's purified, it's a self-transcendent state. And that allows that empathy and to recognition that the boundaries that are sometimes erected between oneself and others are largely illusory. And we see that throughout various different Buddhist traditions, the same also in the Zen tradition, that dissolving that boundary between self and other is what gives rise to the enlightenment experience, and therefore to the altruistic actions and the compassionate actions. So I think, you know, what that quote that you mentioned really speaks to is this idea that the practices are not undertaken for one's own personal, ultimately for one's personal benefit, personal exaltation, escape from suffering, but really for, on behalf of humanity and all sentient beings as a whole. And I think it's really, and the tradition itself is very, very adamant in emphasizing that at all points, because, you know, of course, these practices, you know, you can, you know, the endorphins start surging and you can feel great. And unless that is always sort of kept in mind, that this is about raising a collective standard for humanity as a whole and trying to bring everybody into that that wave, if you will, that self, you know, that transcends unnecessary suffering and builds resilience and builds empathy. And as you say, sometimes it's certainly hell, you know, there is a that aspect is not as emphasized, I think, in the Hindu tradition. The Shaiva tradition can be a little bit sort of wrathful. But, you know, I've been quite personally involved in the Shaiva tradition as well. And certainly from the inside, it has a different flavor than it has, at least when I read about it, the Shaiva Tantra. And, you know, there's a beautiful sense of community within it. And the Shiva, as you know, is translated, you know, is so often understood as a, you know, the snake garlanded god. But Shiva, at least as it's presented in the Trika Shaivism of Kashmir, is just pure vibratory consciousness, awareness, at being brought to a kind of a state in which one transcends all the kind of egoic reifications that keep us in a limited view and experience of reality. So that's a rather long-winded way of trying to comment on that quotation you read from. But I think it does speak to certainly things that I'll try to elaborate in the course of the seminar itself, the online course, because it's the fundamental foundation for everything that's done in Tibetan yoga is to do it for on behalf of all beings and with an attitude of compassion and altruistic intent.
Well, I think that was actually very eloquently and very concisely put, given the breadth of the topic within Buddhist traditions. So, and really a great way to end today. I think something our world and our current moment that we're in right now could use some more of, some self-transcendent empathy and compassionate action. So thank you so much, Ian, for joining the Yogic Studies podcast today, for sharing with us your life's work, your story, your scholarship, and for offering this new online course. I really hope listeners enjoyed this today, and we invite you to join us for this online course journey, diving into the depths of Tibetan yoga. Is there anything else that we missed, Ian, or that you need to add?
No, I think that was pretty comprehensive. I really thank you so much for orchestrating this and for your very insightful and questions and comments. And I really look forward to sharing more in the context of the online course.
Wonderful. Me too, Ian. Of course, we'll be in touch very soon. And thanks again to you and to our listeners. Everybody, please take care, and we'll talk soon. Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation and would like to support the show, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating on iTunes. As always, we are grateful for your support. Thanks so much, everyone, and please take care.